Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see. Nothing to see. Nothing to see.
You are listening to Nothing to See Here, a program of experimental spoken word radio produced by David Clark. This episode is entitled Food for Thought.
I used to live in Vancouver, and I by sheer necessity, I was on Granville Island. It's like a kind of tourist trap, and everything is super overpriced there. And I bought a ham croissant sandwich, and it was ridiculously overpriced. It was like $7. It was really, really expensive. And I think I was couriering at the time. So basically, I just had a delivery on Granville Island. I decided to treat myself. I sat on the harbor, and I started to eat the sandwich. And I'm just sort of like contemplating my life, not having a particularly good day or bad. And I'm not even halfway through, and a seagull swoops in. Not even halfway through a croissant sandwich, I swoops in, like, and there's a crowd of tourists gathering around me, and everyone like gasps. The f***ing thing takes my croissant sandwich, flies away with it, the whole thing, and I don't remember whether I was really mad or whether I laughed, but maybe both. But it was like both funny and tragic at the same time. It's not. I hate seagulls.
I like to sit by my window alongside my plants when it's sunny outside. I sometimes open the windows. I create a small crack for the delicate air to breeze into the room and caress my cheeks. When I sit by my window, I sit in my leather chair. I have positioned it so that I can look out of the cracked window with my right eye, and still yet facing my living room with my left. I'm often very drawn to my leather chair in the morning. When I drink my coffee, and I carry it around for a bit too long so that it gets a bit slow. Sorry, I mean cold. I meant to then say, I take very slow sips. It's as if I'm waiting for it to get cold, but I don't really like the coffee when it is cold. That's really when I like to sit by my windows, in my leather chair. And below the windows, there is a shelf. On the shelf, I have plants, but I have moved them away from the window now, because it didn't make them feel so good.
In grad school, we used to play this game all the time that was like our origin story as a writer. Maybe this is common among like all arts. Like one of my favorite was that when I was like a little kid, I went to go visit my grandmother, my Swedish grandmother, and she took me to church with her. She's like kind of stereotypically Swedish, like very like commanding and solid and a little bit scary, and she, I was sitting next to her, like, trying, and I wasn't Christian, I was raised Hindu, so I had no idea what was going on, And at one point she leans over to me and she points to this woman. She goes, "That woman's hair is a bird's nest." And I spent like a week trying to figure out. I was like, "But that's like there were no birds in there." Like I couldn't figure out the metaphor. So that was like my mythopoetic origin story as a writer.
See all in the pictures that my daddy showed me. My ears were burning and my lip was trembling. "Is this what you have been up to?" he muttered with a confused voice. "No, daddy, I promise, no." I tried to explain with my most convincing voice.
"Who gave you permission for this?"
he said as he slowly leaned back to sit down on the sofa that stood behind him. He looked like he was about to lose his balance. He looked a bit drunk, actually. "Daddy, Daddy, are you alright, Daddy? Daddy, Daddy, are you alright, Daddy?" I muttered under my breath.
"What? I've told you not to matter. Remember when you speak."
He seemed much angrier than before, and his eyes were fixed on the photographs. I was hoping he would not say something about Mother. "Will you show Mama when she comes back?" I could feel my knees caving in. When I was very young, I had this really unfortunate habit of peeing myself in stressful situations. It could happen in the middle of class, or when I was trying to ask somebody out, or simply when I stood in the queue in the shopping market. But now I could feel this horrible tingle in my stomach again. "Oh, Daddy, I really have to go to the bathroom. It's urgent."
"You're not going anywhere until you explain this."
And he pointed at the photograph.
"But Daddy, Daddy, it's urgent. It's just like before, like before."
"What do you mean, like before?"
I couldn't hold it in anymore, and I saw her daddy slowly lowered his head, and he began to look at my trousers instead of my face.
"I promise, Daddy, it wasn't me. It wasn't me.
I said, beggingly. He didn't say anything after that. He just stared at the pool of urine that was shaping itself around my ankles.
I don't know if any of you have ever been to therapy for anxiety, but one of the things that they really teach you is like you should ground yourself, you should like focus on your senses. And like there's nothing I think that I do that is more sensory than cooking. Like it engages like every single one of your senses, and you have to be so like attuned to what's going on. And then you have like this beautiful end result that you can share with people or just like stuff your face with. And sometimes it all goes terribly wrong and you end up like on the floor. And that's like a kind of catharsis too.
Thank you. I think my relationship with food is particularly curious. When I was growing up, I used to really think that I didn't like food and I didn't really like eating. And I'm a pretty small guy to begin with, right? And I think a lot of it comes from like improper nutrition when I was younger. And I just thought I had a really sort of odd relationship with food, but then it turned out that I just didn't like my mother's cooking. And I think probably a few people would agree with me on that. And she would even go as far as to say that she's not actually that good of a cook. She can do a lot of other great things, but cooking isn't her forte. And we discovered this when I started cooking. When I was about 14 years old, or maybe 15, she said she had enough barbecuing and then that would be my job. And so I started barbecuing. And that was sort of my first experience. And the first ones didn't go very well. I had a tendency to undercook things. I like my food pretty rare. And my parents like it very well done. So that was a learning experience for sure. I went away for university and was living on my own for a while, for about 3 years. And my first 2 years I was living in residence and I had a meal plan, so I wasn't cooking a lot. But in my third year I was in an apartment and then I really had to start cooking and I became obsessed with nutrition and getting like the most out of a meal with the least possible investment. So I would just basically make shepherd's pie, like every 3 days. I would make 3 days worth of shepherd's pie. So I would have my potatoes, my carrots, my beef in mushroom sauce. And I slowly added vegetables to it to make it more dense. I brought in broccoli and corn at some point. And that's what I would eat. I ate that for a year straight. Super, super nutritious, super efficient. But we still weren't really at a point where I was thinking too much about flavors. And then I moved back from Toronto and I got into a kitchen here in Halifax after working a couple other jobs and started to learn. And I got to learn from like many, many cooks from around the world. The first kitchen I was at had a bunch of cooks from the Philippines and a cook from Korea. And they kind of taught me everything I know. And it was the weirdest thing. The more I was around food, the more I got to experiment with it, the more I realized like I had this sort of natural ability for flavor. It was almost like I could look at a jar of spices or I could look at like a certain amount of spices, like a handful, and I knew exactly how the food would come out tasting. Like I knew exactly how much spice I had to put in to get what I wanted. If there's perhaps one weird thing in me where like emotions connect with something else, it's like when I look and I smell a bunch of spices, I know exactly how the food is going to come out. So the last 6 or 7 years, I've probably been like obsessing over flavor in the same way that someone would obsess over a color palette. I was reading about people that are apparently these super tasters that have like 10 times the amount of taste buds that normal people have. And I don't know if I'm necessarily that high, but I don't know. I have like this sinking suspicion that maybe because I describe flavors that other people don't seem to necessarily understand, and I can find flavors in food quicker than other people seem to be able to find them. My father was a brilliant cook. Clearly I didn't get it from my mother, but my father was a brilliant cook. He was from El Salvador. Every morning you turn on the pot, you add some new beans, and you add what vegetables you have and your spices and everything. You know, the times that I had him cook, like, it was friggin' brilliant. And so, I don't know, today I was sitting there wondering with Maeve, I made that masala from scratch, and I was sitting there thinking, like, If he had been around and I had learned from him, I wonder if I would be at like a Michelin-starred restaurant at this point or something.
...1976, right before I went to Chicago. I had a friend in high school, Marlene, that I went to England to go to university. She went to Bradley University in Peoria, Illinois. I came back a couple of years later. I'm going into one of the buildings at Yale. Who's walking out the door but Mar? She had a really, really, really astute way of playing the flute. And she ended up getting her MFA at Yale with probably the preeminent flautist in the world. And he arranged for her recital to be at Carnegie Hall in New York. So we went down to Carnegie Hall. I went to see her recital. Afterwards, we went down a couple doors on 57th Street to the Russian Tea Room, which I think is still around. I'm not sure. And I'm eating Bellinis, which are small wheat pancakes stacked with black caviar and poured with butter with sour cream. It's basic diet food. So she's all of a sudden kicks me to the table and sort of looks at me, is like, who's next? So if we look over, it's Dick Cavett and Rudy Avnerieff after one of their TV concerts. So she just starts talking to them. So we spent 45 minutes talking to Rudolf Nureyev and Dick Cavett eating Bellinis in the Russian Tea Room.
Pointlessness can either manifest as anxiety or as absolute bliss, either one. So it just depends what kind of day it is. Bliss in the way that it's like you feel very nice and empty and there's no pressure and everything is falling into place and everything will happen for a reason and it's fine and it's all funny. But yeah, sometimes it's the opposite.
The catharsis, the thing is, I mean, catharsis is it's kind of a terrible term. Right? I mean, it means like purging, right? Like it's a Greek for really like getting rid of everything in your body, right? My argument for many years has been that a state of heightened awareness that allows one to be academically and intellectually productive is absolutely the same as a state of generalized anxiety. Because your brain is heightened and you're working at a heightened state, and that allows you to link ideas that are actually quite abstract and complex because you're able to make those connections. Whereas when you're grounded, calm, balanced, harmonious with your surroundings, you don't make those connections.
Really?
I don't think so.
I feel like that's such a conundrum because I don't know if I agree, but then I do. I feel like I spent the whole of third year at university in this heightened state of feeling like absolutely, yeah, riddled with anxiety, but really productive and spending all my time doing work. But then when you're really calm as well, it's a different kind of thought process going on, but it can be the same as that in a way.
I mean, I don't think it has to be like either or. I think both can be true for different people. But first of all, do you know the term stress?
No.
It's like the good stress. It's like the stress that makes you productive. Like, ideally, you should be somewhere. Like, you shouldn't have no stress, and you shouldn't have all the stress. You need to have the right kinds of stress, and psychologists call this stress. ER.
My grandmother spent 49 years teaching at the Moscow State University. My grandmother's colleague was doing something called, medical geography.
And it's a science that's now completely obscure. But in the Soviet Union at the time, it was extremely important. And the science was linking different medical conditions to the chemicals that were found in the soil. And basically it was like, I can't at all name the kind of diseases that were associated, but there were certain diseases that were like attributed to one thing, but were actually quite evidently because of the heightened presence of these like heavy metals in the soil, for example. And then, you know, the local population eats whatever isn't grown in the soil locally, because in the Soviet Union, the distribution networks were a lot less sort of developed, and then they get ill. At the same time, I remember having a hitchhiking journey. This was part of the Moscow to Berlin adventure, and we got picked up by an East German who studied psychological engineering. And the way that that works, and this is another science that's completely like it's extinct now, is she would analyze the kind of things that would happen where engineers had planned for one thing, but the opposite thing happens because of psychology. Wow. And so what that meant was that, like, for example, if you're driving down the road, as far as engineering is concerned, the road is designed perfectly. Like, everything is fine and dandy. The banks are appropriate. At the curbs, there's the right elevation and angle, etc. But for some reason, at a particular spot, there are like a disproportionate amount of accidents. Mm. She goes, well, of course, because you can see here that there are windmills. And the windmills are turning a particular direction, so people are, like, being distracted as a kind of visual, right? Or you see that the bridge...
Yeah.
So we were driving down the road, and these are the examples she's telling us, right? Or, like, a bridge has a slight curve to it, and then it sort of, like, forces drivers to start turning rightwards, sort of almost subconsciously. Etc. So, you know, I love these archaic sciences because we always think of like science as being objective. It's like directly proportional to national interests, you know, to how grants are given, to how research is funded, to how science and scientists are, you know, well, I mean, obviously this is the case, but sometimes it's good to remind myself.
So I think food's best when you're just really exhausted. So one of the best meals I had was, we did the West Coast Trail a couple years ago, me, my dad, and his friend, and his daughter. And we got like 3 days in, 4 days in, and we're like pretty hungry. We packed pretty light, and the meals that we're cooking are like a lot smaller than we were imagining. So we're like bartering like Cliff Bars and like Baby Bells, and just super hungry. And then we come along to this area near the coast, and there's this fish shop set up, this restaurant that lives like full time out of a camp, and sells to the hikers there, and they catch fish, like fresh fish, every day. So we went there and had the fish there, and it was amazing because you're just so exhausted. And then another time would be the Birkenbeiner, which is a 55k ski race in Alberta, and they always have like food halfway through or in sections, so you like stop and have like a soup, and there's like Nanaimo bars, but everything's like a little bit frozen because usually it's pretty cold, so it's like kind of chewy, crunchy Nanaimo bars. And then you get to the end, and there's this huge tent, and in the tent there's like hot food and chili and this huge buffet for everyone that was just skiing. And you're all kind of exhausted and enjoying like the post-race like day. So that's kind of, I think, when I've enjoyed food the most.
Maeve and mine, our anniversary, we've been together 5 years on March 14th. And it wasn't like we fell madly in love, like, right away or anything. It wasn't like we met and we're like, oh, we're getting married. But we definitely enjoyed each other's company and everything. And that first year was really great. And I was living at home. I was back at NASCAD in first year. And I moved back in with my parents in Sackville and to save money. And Maeve was living in Halifax, and that was fine. Like, we were commuting and everything. And I had been living on my own when we first met and, like, had made some meals and everything. But I don't think anything, like, super major. And then when I moved back home, like, that kind of, like, put a kibosh on cooking because it was my mother's kitchen and, like... You know, I like to cook in my kitchen and I don't like to cook in other people's kitchens because other people have different rules about their kitchens and my mother's very particular about her kitchen and I don't cook in her kitchen. So I wasn't really cooking stuff for a long time or for that bit there, but then that summer, we had been together for over a year at this point, we had been together well over a year at this point, and, we were talking about moving in together. So it was the summer before second year at NASCAD, and we were talking about moving in together, and we pretty much decided to move in together. I guess then my parents went away. My parents were away for a week, and we had the house to ourselves for a week. And that was really our first opportunity to see what living together would be like. I guess, which was really good. I made a big meal, and it was a very simple meal.
I think it was just potatoes, vegetables.
And I made a cheese sauce.
Yeah, some...
And I made a cheese sauce.
Some sauces.
And it was, like, super nutritious, and it was, like, really good. And I think I remember Maeve at the end of it saying, like... Geez, if this is the meal I'm getting, I don't mind cleaning up. And, like, that was pretty sweet. And, like, I don't know, from that point on, like, food became, like, a really important thing for me. It helped me realize that it was something I could offer to people and have it be a very, like, sort of selfless offer. You know, I could put a lot of thought and feeling and sort of desire into the flavor and decisions into the flavor of what I was trying to make for someone, and I could fill them up. And so that was really nice. That kind of showed me that I could really positively affect my loved ones with an offering of food.
You have been listening to Nothing to See Here. This episode was entitled Food for Thought. It featured the voices and contributions of Gregory Gann, Lucien Easton, Jaya Senquist, Raph McDonald, Michael Day, Olivia Brelsford-Massey, Devin Chambers, and Maeve Mulroy. The sound design and mixing were by David Clark. Nothing to See Here is produced by David Clark. For more episodes, please search for Nothing to See Here Radio on SoundCloud.com.